Let's do this. Let me ask you a question. If I wanted to go from from where we're at to Nashville today, what would you recommend? Like, which direction should I go? Obviously north, but what's my easiest route to Nashville, Tennessee, from Decatur, Huntsville, Athens, Alabama, to get on what? I-65 north. Okay, so I know you guys think I-65 north is the way to go, but what I'm going to do is, I don't really like I-65 north, I-65 interstate as much as I like I-20. I-20 runs east to west in the U.S. I don't know if you know this or not, but I'll increase your knowledge if you don't know how the interstate systems work in the U.S., and so everything that ends with a 5 runs north and south, and everything that ends with a 0 runs east and west. In the U.S. And then you start on the west coast with the lowest interstate is Interstate 5, runs north and south down the west coast all the way over to Interstate 95 on the east coast. And then, same thing, Interstate 10 runs across the Florida Panhandle all the way up into the northern. So what I prefer is to drive on I-20, which is the road between Atlanta and Birmingham and then on. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to go to Nashville on I-20, okay? I'm just going to keep driving I-20. I prefer the scenery. I prefer the rest stops. I prefer the stops along the way. And so I'm just going to drive I-20 until I get to Nashville. Am I going to be okay? Am I ever going to get to Nashville? I prefer to get to Nashville on I-20. I know you guys are telling me 65, but I prefer 20. And I think 20 is going to get me there. And who are you to say that my way is not like yours, not as good as yours? I want to get to Nashville. I'm just going to take I-20 to get there. You'd look at me like, Devin, you're out of your mind. No matter how long you drive I-20, you're not going to end up in Nashville, Tennessee. There's one way to get to Nashville from here. It's on I-65, and that's the way you're going to go. And so we've been looking at the best friend of Jesus, who's an insider, John, the loved disciple, who, again, one of the closest friends of Jesus on the inner circle. And in John's gospel, he gives us 90% unique material to every other gospel. Okay, so Matthew, Mark, and Luke are the three other gospel writers. The gospel of John was in John. The content of John is 90% unique to John. And so he allows us to listen in on some of the most intimate conversations of Jesus. And his purpose in writing this gospel is to generate belief in who Jesus is, because that's where life is found, is what John tells us. And we have entered into this section of John's narrative that is the last night of the life of Jesus. The last couple of weeks, we've looked at John chapter 13. I would encourage you to go back and listen to those messages. And the first week, we saw how Jesus washed the feet of the disciples in an act of supreme humility. He identified his betrayer as they sat around this table. He told the disciples, like, you guys can't come with me where I'm going, where I go, you can't come. But what I'm instructing you to do is I'm giving you a new command, which is to love each other as I've loved you. Love as Christ. And then there was the whole Peter incident we saw last week, where Peter's like, Jesus, I know, like, you're saying that these other guys aren't going to make it, but I'm going to make it. I'm willing to go with you anywhere, all the way to the end. I'm willing to lay down my life for you if necessary, to which Jesus responded, like, Peter, you're not going to make it through the night. Like, slow your roll. You're not going to make it through the night. But don't worry, again, that God is in control of this. So the words of Jesus have left his disciples very troubled, troubled hearts. As a matter of fact, the very opening phrase of chapter 14 are these words: let not your hearts be troubled, Jesus says. Let not your hearts be troubled. The disciples are stressed. They're worried. Jesus keeps talking about leaving. He keeps talking about suffering. He keeps talking about dying. This word troubled actually means to stir up water, to churn. And that's what troubled hearts do. They create anxiety. They create stress. They create worry. They create instability. Anyone in here have the spiritual gift of freaking out, right? That's what a troubled heart does. A troubled heart is a common diagnosis in our times. Stress, anxiety, worry, these are common experiences for all of us. Now, I think in light of the morning that we've had, at least for me as a dad, I think we need a good joke here, right? kind of lighten the mode. Is that okay? We tell a good joke. Good is still the verdict's still out on good joke, right? This is my favorite stress, anxiety, worry joke. So this guy goes to see his psychiatrist, and he lays down on the couch, and the doctor says, "What's going on?" He's like, "I keep having this recurring dream. It's driving me crazy." He's like, "What are you talking about?" He's like, "Well, one night I dreamed that I'm a wigwam, and the next night I dreamed that I'm a teepee. Over and over, I dreamed that I'm a wigwam. I dreamed that I'm a teepee. I dreamed that I'm a wigwam. I dreamed that I'm a teepee. I think I'm losing my mind, doc." And the doctor says, "No, you're not losing your mind." He's like, "Well, what is it?" He said, "Well, this is a pretty simple diagnosis. You are too tense." Too tense. Wigwam, teepee, you're too tense. I'm explaining them. It's not good when you have to explain them. The troubled heart. We could all be diagnosed with a troubled heart. And I want to ask you today, like, what is it that troubles your soul today? Is it your finances? Is it death? Is it sickness? Is it your job? Is it parenting in this day and age? Is it some type of struggling relationship? Is it guilt that plagues your heart? Is it anger? Is it shame? There's a lot of things that can trouble, can stir up our hearts. And Jesus speaks to the troubled heart today. He speaks to the troubled heart. And here's what he says. Let not your hearts be troubled. Believe in God. Believe also in me. Now, put that in context. Like, don't forget who, in this incident in John 14, don't forget who is headed for the agony of the cross. It's not the disciples. It's Jesus. Jesus is the one that is headed to the agony of the cross. And yet, on this darkest of nights, when it seems that Jesus should be receiving comfort and support, he is the one offering comfort and encouragement and support and teaching to his followers. It is Jesus, the one that we've already read, that the stress is weighing on his soul for all that is happening. Yet in this moment, it is Jesus that is speaking to his followers, and he says, "Don't let your heart be troubled. Believe in God, believe also in me." The way we are directed to calm our troubled heart by Jesus is to trust God and trust also in me, Jesus says. Now, don't miss this. Jesus identifies himself as an appropriate object of faith. In other words, Jesus says, you can put your faith in me. Just as you can put your faith in God, it is appropriate, he says, for you to put your faith in me. Jesus is saying, you can trust me. Just like you can trust God the Father, you can trust me. Now, what he's doing here is he's identifying himself as God. He's putting himself on the equal plane as the Father. You can trust God, and you can also trust me. I am an appropriate object of faith. Like, you can trust me. All throughout the New Testament, we see oftentimes that his followers would worship him. Throughout all Scripture, it's very clear that we're only to worship one person. We're only to worship God. And so when Jesus allows himself to be worshiped, he's saying, I'm equal with God. You can worship me. When he says about himself, like, you can put faith in me, he's saying, I am God. I am an object that is worthy of your faith. I am an object that is worthy of your trust. You can trust me, Jesus says. Like we get this. We get that those who are, when you're a parent, when you're a dad with children, and today, you know, again, Levi turns 3, and there's a person, at least one person in his life that he trusts completely. Like, he trusts his daddy. If it's jump to me, or if it's follow me, or if it's do this, like he'll trust me, even beyond sometimes his mom, right? There's times we're doing something physical, like, hey, I want you to jump off of this and jump to daddy, that he wants to make sure it's daddy that's catching him and not mommy. I don't know if it's the size difference or whatever. In the last few days, for some reason, Levi's decided to use the phrase, daddy's big, a lot. I'm like, what are you trying to put me on a weight loss plan? Like, what's going on here, son? But even yesterday, like, daddy's huge. Daddy's huge. What? I'll show you huge. But anyways, but image in his mind, right, is daddy's strong, daddy's big, daddy can be trusted. I can jump to daddy. Daddy can be trusted. And what Jesus is saying here is, I can be trusted. I am the one you can put your faith in. And he goes on to say, my departure is purposeful. There's a reason why I am departing. So for Jesus to tell his followers not to worry but to trust, there has to be ample reason for Jesus to be trusted. This is very important. Jesus is not saying, hey, I know you got a lot going on. I know your heart's troubled. Just trust. Just believe. Just have a little more faith. You got that person in your life? Your troubled soul? Something's going on in your life, and you got that person who's like, hey, just have a little more faith. Just trust a little more. And you're like, okay, I get, like, trust a little more, but that's not what I need right now. My soul's troubled. Like, I get it. It can become very cliche, right? Just trust a little more. Have a little more faith. Everything will be all right if you have a little more faith. And that verbiage, oftentimes with good intentions, seems kind of cliche when your heart's troubled, when your soul is troubled, which is why what Jesus has to say next is so important. What he has to say next lets us know why we can trust him. Jesus is not just saying, hey, just trust, just have a little more faith, everything will be okay. Jesus goes on to say, here's why I can be trusted. So let's walk through this together. Here's what he says. Believe in God, believe also in me. Beginning of verse 2, in my Father's house are many rooms. So like the first reason Jesus says you can be trusted, that he can be trusted, is that there's plenty of space in the Father's house. He has come from the Father's house, and there's plenty of space in the Father's house. Now, I don't know if it's kind of the era of Christianity that I grew up in, but I can't even read or think about this verse without hearing the song in my head. My Father's house, it's a big, big house with lots and lots of room. It's a big, big table with lots and lots of food. Here we go, Alabama people. It's a big, big yard where we can play football. Who wrote that song? I don't know about the theology behind it, but it sticks in your head, right? It's a big, big house. Has anyone not heard that song? Don't go look it up. Don't listen to it. That's all you'll think about. Big house. We've all probably been through big, beautiful homes before. If you've ever toured like the Biltmore House in Western North Carolina or different places, there are big, beautiful homes. But the idea here of house is the idea of security. It's the idea of belonging. It's the idea of family. It is the idea of a place where you are welcome. There's a welcome mat at the door in the Father's house. It is a place where you are invited. And Jesus says you can be trusted because there's plenty of space in the Father's house. In his language here, the emphasis is on the availability of the residence, not the size or style of the home. Now, I'll tell you what happened to us. As they were translating Bibles from original language down through the years and years and years, there's a bunch of Latin guys that came along and decided they were going to translate this into the word, guess what? Mansion. Mansion. Mansion's not anywhere in the text. This has nothing to do with mansions. I'm getting ready to shatter some of your hopes. This has not anything to do with a mansion. It doesn't have anything to do with the style of home, any type of home. Some of you already had it like picked out. I'm gonna be living on 134 Hallelujah Avenue in my big gold mansion. This has nothing to do with mansions. And there's even been songs written about mansion. I've got a mansion over the hilltop and all these songs written about mansion. But this has nothing to do with mansion. What it has to do with is that there is plenty of room for you in the presence of God, that you will not be turned away, that you are welcome, that you are invited. And Jesus says, believe in me. I can be trusted. I can be trusted because in my Father's house, there is plenty of room for you. And so I invite you today, if you're not a follower of Jesus, to believe in Jesus, because there is room in the Father's house. There is room in the presence of God for those who turn and believe in Jesus. But the next reason that Jesus says he can be trusted, look at as this verse continues, in my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? So Jesus says, I can be trusted because there's space in the Father's kingdom for you. And also, Jesus himself is preparing this place. Jesus says, I'm preparing this place. Now, this statement that Jesus made presupposes that the Father's house exists, that it's there, that it exists before Jesus gets there. This is not the idea that Jesus is up in heaven building mansions. like that Jesus has a hammer and nail and wearing a tool belt and out there like, all right, I can get this thing built before they get here. That's not the image here. It's not, well, it's a good thing that Jesus was a carpenter on earth because he's got like a lot of mansions to build when he gets to heaven. That's not the concept. And then my mind just goes crazy, like Jesus with the board, like, Gabriel, can you come hold this for me? And you get, so yesterday, one of the gifts we got for Levi for his birthday is a trampoline. Which, again, you need basically a doctor's degree to put together now. Not necessarily the trampoline, but everything else that keeps you safe on the trampoline. The mat and the netting and none of that stuff that I didn't grow up with because my parents obviously didn't love me. It was just like, here's kind of a trampoline and it's 8 feet off the air, 8 feet in the air, and if you fall off, good luck. And mine was rectangular shaped, right? Which means the width of it was about the width of this rug. So the likelihood that you're going off that trampoline or through the springs, pretty high, right? So I can attribute a lot of what goes on in my head today to the amount of times I fell or was pushed or knocked or kicked off of the trampoline. But not today. Not today. There's mats, there's nets, there's protective clothing and helmets for the kids to put them on the trampoline where they can't even jump. It's just kind of... here's my trampoline experience. Whee, whee, whee. There's no fun in this trampoline experience. But back to the story, I'm putting together this trampoline while Levi's gone to little Davy's birthday party, who's 1 year and 1 day older than Levi. So his birthday is yesterday, turned 4. Levi's today turns 3. He's at Davy's party. Mommy had to go out and buy stuff at the birthday party. So I'm like, I've got a 3-hour window of time to put together this trampoline. So about, I put the first half of it together. Then the kids came and kind of helped. One of them helped, the other two kind of helped. I won't call out the three, but so we finally got this sucker put together. And so then I'm like not Mr. Handyman, and so I made it clear to Levi, like, Daddy built this trampoline while you were gone. Like, you were gone, and now you have a trampoline, and Daddy built this trampoline. Daddy built it. And so now, like, when he talks about these trampolines, like, Daddy built the trampoline. Like, yeah, you got it right. Daddy built the trampoline. Like, I got to get as much credit as I can. I think in his mind, he thinks I, like, constructed the poles and everything. So put it together is what happened. But the image of Jesus here is not that he's up in heaven putting together trampolines and building houses with his hammer and nails and tool belt. The idea is that Jesus is preparing the place, that he is preparing a place for us. So listen, here's the key to understanding what he means here. What Jesus is saying, it is the going through what's about to happen, through the cross, through the resurrection, that prepares the place for his followers. Jesus says, I'm going and preparing a place for you. What's about to happen is he's about to go through the cross, about to go through the resurrection, and it's through the death and resurrection of Jesus that this place is prepared for his followers. We can trust him because he has prepared the way for us through the cross and resurrection. Now, let me apply this for us immediately right here. This reminder that Jesus has prepared a place for us through the cross, through the resurrection, should immediately shift our focus from the dwelling and the stuff that we're trying to put together here. It should immediately shift our focus from the dwellings and the stuff that we so often strive for on earth. Are we more focused on building what we have here, which, by the way, is eventually just another person's junk? Are we more focused on what we accumulate, on what we build, on what we have here, or on what he has prepared for us beyond the grave? Our eyes seem to get so focused on the here and now. What can I build? What kind of home do I have? What kind of car do I drive? How much is in the bank account? Do I have the latest TV? Do I have this? Do I have that? We get so focused on our temporary dwellings, our temporary stuff, that when we see the cross, the way that's been prepared for us, it should shift our focus from the here and now to the there, to the big picture. Jesus says, I can be trusted. I can be trusted because my Father's house has plenty of room. I can be trusted because I've prepared the way to the Father's house for you. Let's jump in verse 3. as he continues, why Jesus can be trusted. And if I go and prepare a place for you, Jesus says, I will come again and take you to myself, that where I am, you may be, and you know the way to where I am going. Jesus says, I can be trusted because if I go away, I will come back and I will take you to be with me. I can be trusted because I'm going away through the cross and resurrection, but that's not the end of the story. I will return again and take you to be with me. I will take my followers to be with me through all eternity. And there's a ton of personal promises in these verses, right? Jesus is like, believe in me, my Father's house. I would have told you, I go, I will return to receive you to myself. Where I am, you will be. These are personal promises of Jesus to his followers. There's an intimacy here, and it's a guarantee by Jesus himself. This guarantee is secured by the person making the promise. And we know all about that. We have people in our lives that we trust that have let us down, and our security gives way, right? We have people that, like, man, that guy will fix your car. He will give you a good price. You can take your car to him every single time. The guarantee's behind the work. We trust that guy because he's shown it to us before. We have other guys like, man, do not take your car there. They will take advantage of you. They didn't even fix my car. They charged me way more, right, than I anticipated. So don't go there. Like, again, the guarantee is always secured by the character, the person themselves. And Jesus says here, I will come back, I will get you, I will take you to be with me. And it is a promise that is guaranteed by who Jesus is. Again, immediate application here. Are we living with an awareness that Jesus is returning? Are we living with an awareness that Jesus is coming back to get his followers? Now, here's what I don't want to do with that. I don't want to preach that in the way that, you know, we're making choices because we're afraid of getting caught. Like, I don't want to be doing this when Jesus comes back. Like, that's not the motive here. That's not the idea here. Instead, it is a mindfulness that I have been created for something more. I have been redeemed by God for something more eternal than what I tend to focus on. I tend to focus on the now. I tend to focus on the temporary. I tend to get distracted by whatever's right in front of me. And what Jesus is doing is he's calling our sight, he's calling our eyes to something bigger than now. He's calling us to remember, I've prepared a place for you and I'm coming back to get you. That we should live with an awareness that he's returning one day. And so my focus should not be distracted by all the stuff that's thrown in front of me. My focus should be on what is bigger than me, that God has created me for something bigger, for something more eternal. That's why these verses are bigger than just a few verses that we read at funerals. Like, you hear these verses read at funerals all the time, and again, it's, you know, appropriate to read at a funeral, but if we think these are just funeral words, we missed it. The idea here is focus on something bigger than you. Be aware that Jesus is coming back to get you. Well, the doubter has something to say. In verse 5, Thomas said to him, Lord, we do not know where you're going. How can we know the way? So Thomas speaks up, and Thomas says, Jesus, how can we know the way? We don't even know where you're going. I know, like I typed into my Google Maps, mansion over the hilltop, and like nothing came up. I don't even know where you're going, Jesus. How can I know the way? And the reason he typed in mansion over the hilltop and nothing came up is because I told you, mansion's not the right translation here. Jesus, how are we going to know the way? We don't even know where you're going. Verse 6, Jesus gives us another reason that he can be trusted. Jesus said to him, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Jesus can be trusted because he is the way to the Father. An important nuance here. Jesus does not show us the way. Jesus is the way. You get that? Jesus does not just show us the way to the Father. Jesus is the exclusive way to the Father. Now, let's just talk for a moment. This type of exclusive claim that Jesus makes here, it stirs fervent opposition in our culture of religious diversity and religious pluralism. And sometimes the hostility is not so much toward Christianity itself, but the exclusivity of such a claim. Like, how can you possibly claim that Jesus is the only way to God? I don't. He does, right? It's like, I don't claim that. Jesus claims that. Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. It is his claim. Jesus says, there's one way to Nashville. Get on 65 North to go to Nashville. Jesus is the one that says, I-20 is an awesome interstate, but it's not going to get you there. There is one way to the Father. In our day and age, tends to view all religious systems as simply kind of variants of each other that all have these kind of common themes, that all religious systems kind of point the way toward God, whatever that God may look like in each system, that these religious systems all kind of call us to some type of life of devotion toward this God, right? That you're devoted to this system, to this God. And then also most religious systems teach that this should result in some type of appropriate behavior toward other humans. For the most part, there are some religious systems that don't even really conclude that part in it. And so the idea here is that most people in our culture, in our day and age, and the world system that we live in, they believe that kind of all these religious systems are just kind of variants of each other. That they're all saying believe in God, that they're all saying, like, you know, have a devotion to this God, and that that should result in the appropriate behavior that we have toward other humans. Basically, the image you'll see sometimes that there are many paths all up the same mountain. As long as you get up the mountain, then everything's okay. And so to stand amid these many religious traditions and to claim that there's something exclusive, that there's something unique, that there's something matchless, that there's something superior, that there is something unparalleled to every other system is offensive to this type of reasoning, at least when it comes to religious devotion. Like, we don't really believe that when it comes to things outside of religion. Let me illustrate. Like, if I had a child that had some type of life-threatening disease, and I took that child to a doctor, and a doctor said, look, I've got the cure for this. Like, I can treat your child with this medicine and only this medicine, and your child will be well. Guaranteed. This medicine will cure this disease. I can treat him, and there is a 100% guarantee that this medicine will treat and cure this disease. And I'm like, man, that's awesome. Now, doctor, how much is this going to cost? It's not going to cost you anything. It is 100% free. It is a medicine that guarantees the healing of your child. It is a medicine that is 100% free to you. It is a free gift to you. How insane would you think that I was to step back and say, that is offensive to me? Like, how dare you think your medicine is the only medicine? How dare you think your cure is the only cure? There's got to be other cures out there. How dare you think that you can give this to me for free? It is offensive to me that you have a message that says your medicine is the only cure. There's got to be other stuff out there. And I think if I take this other medicine, even though there's no guarantee of the cure, I think that this medicine's just as legitimate as yours. Like, it's offensive to me for you to think yours is the only one. You would say, Devin, you are out of your mind. If that's the only cure, take the cure. Be grateful for it. Be appreciative of it. And so it's only in this matter of religious devotion that we think in these exclusive terms, isn't it? Almost every other area of life, we're okay with this is the way, this is the path, here's the cure. But when it comes to religion, we've kind of divided this up to where it becomes offensive. And so the claim of Jesus here, and I want to emphasize that, the claim of Jesus here is that he is the way. Not merely he points the way, he is the truth. Not merely that he just teaches truth, he is the life. Not just one avenue to life. Jesus says, there's no options. I am the way, the truth, the life. No one comes to the Father except by me. What Jesus is saying here is that the human quest for God ends in Jesus. That he is the only way, only truth, only life. And John, writing these words of Jesus, invites us to place our faith in Jesus. Not in a religious system, not in his teachings, not in his behavior, not in his practices, not in Christian moral lessons. John invites us to place our faith in Jesus alone. Now let me emphasize this. This message that I'm preaching today is good news. It's good news. It's the announcement of good news that there is an inclusion to the exclusive claims of Jesus. And so in a world of troubled hearts, the good news of the gospel says there is a way to God. There is truth. There is life. And his name is Jesus. That's good news. I like what the early church fathers, Thomas Kempis, writes about this. Here's what Kempis has to say. Follow thou me, Jesus says. I am the way and the truth and the life. Without the way, there is no going. Without the truth, there is no knowing. Without the life, there is no living. I am the way which you must follow, the truth which you must believe, the life for which you must have hope. I am the inviolable way, the infallible truth, the never-ending life. I am the straightest way, the sovereign truth, life true, life blessed, life uncreated. I am the way, the truth, and the life. Now, important. There's always going to be Phillips. Verse 7 and 8. Jesus says, if you had known me, you would have known my Father also. From now on, you do know him and have seen me. Philip has something to say. Philip said to him, Lord, show us the Father, and it is enough for us. There's always going to be Philips. I wish God would just show up. I wish God would just reveal himself. I wish God would just remove the ambiguity by revealing himself, by showing up. I wish God would just take the uncertainty out of the picture and just show up. That's a fair question. And here's the answer. He has. He has done that. His name is Jesus. His name is Jesus. Look at what Jesus says. Verse 9, this text continues. Jesus said to him, have I been with you so long and you still do not know me, Philip? Whoever has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, show us the Father? Do you not believe that I am in the Father and the Father is in me? The words that I say to you, I do not speak on my own authority, but the Father who dwells in me does his works. Believe in me that I am in the Father and the Father is in me, or else believe on account of the works, the signs themselves. So Jesus gives us the next reason that he can be trusted here. It's the fifth reason if you're keeping track. Jesus can be trusted because God has shown himself in Jesus. God has revealed himself. God has spoken in Jesus. God himself was in Christ. Here's what that means. Jesus did not just claim to be right about God. Listen. Jesus did not claim to be right about God. Jesus claimed to be God, that he is God. He says here, like the miracles, man, they're just signposts. We've seen that in all of John's gospel. If you think back, if you've been here for the Belief Project for any length of time, you remember there were seven signs in John's gospel, all these signs pointing to who Jesus is. Jesus says, these works, these miracles, they're just signposts pointing to who I am. The words of Jesus are true because they are the words of God. the way is superior, not because it promotes some type of higher ethic than other religious systems. The way is superior because people are drawn to God only through Jesus. He is the way. There's no other way. Jesus does not just offer you a better life. Jesus is life. To know him is to live, Jesus says. Philip says, Jesus, show us the Father and it will be enough. Jesus says, Philip, I and the Father are one. To see and know me, Jesus says, is to see and know God. I am the way. I am the truth. I am the life. It is not that Jesus was sent on some type of divine mission on behalf of the Father. The Father is on a divine mission in the life of the Son. Jesus is God. You cannot know the Father outside of Jesus. You cannot know God outside of Jesus. Now, here's my final thought for all of this. So these 11 verses are bookend by the same concept, the same invitation. Verse 1, let not your hearts be troubled. Believe in God. Believe also in me. Verse 11, believe in me that I am in the Father and the Father is in me. There's two bookends that stand on each side of these 11 verses. And they both have the same invitation. Believe in Jesus. Believe in me. Jesus says. So if you are not a follower of Jesus, I invite you to believe in Jesus, to believe in who he is. I don't invite you to a life that is superior to other religious systems and the ethics that they promote. If I'm honest with you, there's other religious systems that teach a more devotion to their religion than Christianity does. There are other religions that their adherents, they're a lot more religiously active, more faithful to their teachings than the average Christian is. So I'm not inviting you to a higher ethic or some type of moral lifestyle or some type of stop doing this and start doing this. I am inviting you to put your faith in a person who claimed to be the Son of God. And that is either true or it's untrue, but there's no middle ground here. Either Jesus is God or he is not God. And if he is God, which I believe he validated because he died and came back to life, if he is God, put your faith in him. He is the way. He is the truth. He is the life. Believe in him. Believe in Jesus. One of the first steps, we're celebrating baptism next week. One of the first steps of belief in Jesus is to take that step of obedience to say, I believe in Jesus. And that's what baptism is. I was alive outside of Jesus. I have died to myself in Jesus, and I am being raised back to life spiritually to live in faith with Jesus as a Jesus follower. And so I invite you, even with baptism, like if that's your next step of faith, to take that step, to say, yes, I want to identify with that. I want people to know I believe in Jesus. And so I invite you, if you haven't taken that step of belief, of baptism, take that step next week. Put it on your card. Let us know. We'll talk to you. We'll get it lined up. But that's an awesome first step of obedience to belief in Jesus. Now, let me end this message in a little different way than how you often hear this text taught. Because I want us to remember to whom Jesus is talking here. Jesus is not standing on the side of a mountain talking to people who are not followers. Jesus is not standing at a Billy Graham crusade with thousands and thousands of people who are waiting to walk an aisle. Jesus is not speaking to people who are not believers. Who's he speaking to? He is speaking to his followers. He is speaking, here it is, to troubled heart followers. People whose hearts are troubled, who follow Jesus, but their hearts are troubled. Now, they don't even know what awaits them. Like if they knew what was coming down the pipeline, they would really be troubled, right? And so what awaits these followers of Jesus? One, they're on the eve of the crucifixion of Jesus. They're going to watch Jesus hang on a cross, murdered. They're on the eve of the resurrection, right? A lot of them are skeptical about it. Then Jesus comes, shows himself. They're on the eve of the resurrection. They are on the brink of Jesus commissioning them to go into all the world and proclaim the gospel, to establish this Jesus movement that we now know as the church. By the way, when the church was first introduced in the book of Acts, you know what they called the followers of Jesus? Followers of the way. There it is. The way. They are on the verge of this Jesus movement that is going to be birthed, but that's not the end. You know what they're also on the verge of? Every one of these listeners of Jesus will give their lives for Jesus. They'll die gruesome, horrible deaths. They'll be murdered. They'll be, I told you last week, Peter will be hung upside down. Some of them will be stabbed and gutted, and other boiled in oil. I mean, like, all these gruesome things are coming down the pipeline. They will all become martyrs for Jesus. That is troubled heart stuff. And this foundational historical claim of Jesus here, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me, is spoken to followers of Jesus who have no idea what awaits them, but they are invited to believe in Jesus. Not his ethics, not his morals, not his way of life, not his teaching. They are invited to believe in Jesus. The message is what Jesus instructs us. This message is what Jesus instructs us to go into all the world proclaiming. He said, go make disciples, go make followers. And this message is what we are invited to believe. Like, this is not, I don't know if you know the phrase apologetics, but apologetics is like defense of the faith. This is a verse that we hear a lot in apologetics, like Jesus claimed this, and we can use that in apologetics. But the context of this verse is not primarily about evangelism or apologetics or defending the Christian faith. The primary purpose behind this passage and in the context in which it was written is that there are followers of Jesus whose hearts grow troubled, and our invitation is to believe in Jesus. So here's how I want to encourage you as we end today, City Church. I want you to remember, Jesus is the way. Rest in him. Have you ever felt like you lost your way? He is the way. Lean into him. Rest in him. You ever felt like you needed direction in life, like you're purposeless, like you have no direction to go, you don't know what you're going, you're spinning your wheels? Listen, he is the way. Like, rest in him. Jesus' promise is not like, follow me and I'm going to give you clear direction through all matters of life. You're going to know exactly where to go and when to go, and you're, my will's going to be clear for you. That's not the promise of Jesus. Jesus says, lean into me. I am the way. You believe in me. You follow me. And as we rest in Jesus, our direction may not even become clear, but our instruction is clear. Lean in to Jesus. Lean into him. When you are directionless, when you are lost, when you are confused, lean into him. He can be trusted. He is the way. Listen, trouble-hearted follower, Jesus is the truth. Confused? Look around you and think, what's going on? Confused about what's going on in your life? Doubtful? Yeah, me too. Skeptic at times? Yeah, me too. Wondering about the truth. What is the truth? How do we find the truth? How do we get there? Like, all these things being thrown at me, constant barrage of information, like confusion all around us. Who's right? Who's wrong? Yeah, me too. Guess what? He is the truth. He can be trusted. That doesn't mean like, all right, here's all the answers. Here's the handbook on how to know everything in the Bible and why it makes sense, and you never have any doubts or skepticism. Like, no, lean into Jesus. As you doubt, as you have concerns, as you have questions, as you scratch your head, as you are confused, he can be trusted. Just lean into him. Even when he may not even feel trustworthy in your mind, lean into him. He is the truth. You can believe in him even when it comes with that level of, Lord, here's my belief, now help my unbelief. You ever identify with that guy in the New Testament? Jesus says, I am the truth. I am the truth. And because he's the truth, you know what that means? I'm not always going to get it. We sang it in the song this morning. His thoughts are bigger than mine. His ways are beyond mine. Who am I, a finite human being, right, to try and think I can figure out the creator of the universe? There is a belief fact to trust in him. He is the truth. Follower of Jesus, trouble-hearted follower, he's the life. Jesus is life. Ever been in a season in life where you felt like death was winning? When you felt like death was overpowering, you've lost someone, you've lost something, a relationship has been shattered, you don't know where your next paycheck is coming from, you're living check to check to check. You ever been in a place in life where you felt like death is winning, sin is winning, this person was taken prematurely? You ever felt like death was winning? Here's one. You ever felt lifeless? You ever been just drifting through life, feeling lifeless, feeling down, depressed, anxious, like you ever been in life just feeling lifeless? Listen, in those moments, lean into him. He is life. That doesn't mean you're always going to feel vibrant and on top of things and not have struggles in life and not seek to have to find encouragement through the words of Christ or the Holy Spirit working in your life. But understand when those moments where it feels like death is winning, when you feel lifeless, that he is the life. Believe in him. Rest in him. He is enough for you. Jesus is the way, the truth, the life. God, I wish you would just show up. I wish you would just make yourself clear. I wish you would just break through the ambiguity and reveal yourself. God the Father says, I did. His name is Jesus. Run to him. Believe in him. Trust in him. He is the way. He is the truth. He is the life. Broken, troubled, hearted follower of Jesus. Listen, no one comes to him except through Jesus. Stop trying to figure it all out. Stop trying to piece it all together. You want access to the Father? There's access in Jesus. Run to him. Lean into him. Trust him. Believe in him. The way, the truth, and the life.